Welcome to the Church of England's weekly podcast. The past week saw the General Synod of the Church of England meet in Westminster. We hear from the Archbishop of Canterbury, who spoke to Synod about the recent gathering of Anglican primates.
We were conscious, as we met in that week, that literally millions, possibly tens of millions of people were praying for us. And I've never known a week in which I've been so aware of prayer or of pressure.
Father Paul Cartwright tells us why he brought a motion encouraging blood and organ donation to General Synod.
It seems the right thing to do. You know, if we think about stewardship, if stewardship's based around resources, well, these are natural resources which are God-given.
We hear reflections from journalists who are covering the meeting. And in the latest instalment of Just Pray, we hear Rob's story of how he came to faith.
Like, when I started like being clear-headed and things like that, I thought, wow, if a human being can get resurrected after dying, he's done it to me.
Opening the first day's business at General Synod on Monday, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, shared some of his thoughts on last month's gathering of Anglican primates in Canterbury. Here he describes the significance of the final Eucharist in the crypt of Canterbury Cathedral.
We sat in a semicircle around the altar laid for the Eucharist. On one side of it, and a little in front, was the crozier of St. Gregory, Pope Gregory the Great, who had sent Augustine in 597 for the re-evangelization of these islands, at least according to the Roman tradition. The crozier is very beautiful, with inspiration, which I suspect is drawn from the Apocalypse, of a carved ivory lamb rising above attack by a dragon. I was present when it arrived on the Friday before the meeting began and watched as those unpacking it were moved to tears by its beauty and historic significance. It's loaned for the week from the Prior of San Gregorio with the blessing and active support of the British Ambassador to the Holy See and of the Italian authorities and much support from within the Vatican itself. Was a symbol of ecumenical unity that was most remarkable. On the other side of the altar, and just in front of it, were the Augustine Gospels, loaned for the day by Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, and brought down, setting off at 3 a.m., simply for the service. That, again, was a gift that we gratefully received. They are authenticated as dating from the 6th century and are most beautifully illuminated. Again, they provide forceful symbolism of our call to continue in the tradition started so long ago. Before the altar, during the ministry of the word, sat Jean Vanier, who had spoken to us on the Thursday evening after Evensong and addressed us during the Eucharist on John chapter 13, the washing of the feet. He led us both in meditating on that passage and then in washing each other's feet, so that all primates washed each other's feet. It seemed to me as I sat there that much of what we are about as the Anglican Communion, as God's people, was symbolized in the way everything was laid out. The ministry of the sacrament recalled to us that through the sacrament we reaffirm our Catholicity, our essential unity with all Christians everywhere and in every time. The pastoral staff spoke to us of the conquest of evil, of the call for unity, of the shepherding of the people of God in simplicity and holiness. The Gospels, the word of the Scriptures, unfold to us the life of Jesus our Saviour, word and sacraments held together. And Jean Vanier himself, a living symbol of what true simplicity and discipleship means for the life of the Church today. We washed each other's feet and each prayed a blessing on the one who'd washed our feet before washing the feet of the other primates, a great contrast to what is often portrayed as the conflicts within the communion. Many of us were moved to tears. I start there because it sets before us the reality of the Anglican Communion. It is the very work of God, inspired by the Spirit, full of fallible human beings who must confess their sins and who require the comforts of the word and the hope of the sacraments and the example of the saints and the shepherding of those called by God, however weak they may be, into leadership. If we are to be to the world the symbols of unity which are our calling and purpose, and which will enable us to proclaim more confidently the good news of Jesus Christ. We here in this synod are but one very small part of it, both in time and space, and we are called to the covenant of unity, of Catholicity, with past, present, and future. As one part, albeit a small one, we are of infinite value and are held by the grace of God for infinite good. We were conscious, as we met in that week, that literally millions, possibly tens of millions, of people were praying for us. And I've never known a week in which I've been so aware of prayer or of pressure. One of the moments in which we voted, and you don't vote often at these meetings, according to those who've been to several of them, was on the question, when all seemed lost, as to whether we would walk together or separately. And it did seem lost. The vote to walk together, after a warning repeated twice that to undertake to do so meant to take a personal responsibility for it happening properly, was unanimous. It was done by open voting of raised hands and was total. However, the divisions were profound and remain so. We should not have any illusions of the fragility of the process or of the outcome.
And you can hear the full address from the Archbishop by visiting www.soundcloud.com and searching Church of England. The General Synod is back to call for each diocese to encourage their churches and congregations to consider becoming blood donors or registering as organ donors. Members voted to approve a motion from Leeds Diocesan Synod put by Father Paul Cartwright, a former police officer and now a priest in Barnsley, South Yorkshire, aimed at increasing the number of blood and organ donors in the UK. Martha Linden started by asking him what had motivated him to highlight the issue.
Having a background in policing and having been a family liaison officer, caring for those families whose loved ones have been killed in road traffic collisions, it seemed natural that maybe I should volunteer to do it so I could maybe enlighten people to the process and what actually happens and the good that it does.
You saw the impact of organ donation from your viewpoint as a family liaison officer. Just wondered if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, certainly. Sometimes at the time of death or after someone's died as a result of a collision, the health service, we've already started to build relationships with them. And so as a routine, I would ask families whether or not their loved ones had left instructions around the donation of organs or body tissue and whether or not they considered that.
You are unable to donate blood now, I understand. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and your own story, your own personal story?
Certainly. I was really fortunate in that I was able to almost get 100 credits. They used to stamp a little book or give you a little sticker to go in the book. And because I went so often, I racked up very quickly over 100 of these donation points, you could call them. But now I'm unable to give blood because in 2008 I was diagnosed with a kind of acute leukemia, APML, which came on very quickly. I thought I had flu, and before I knew it, I was in hospital beginning my chemotherapy treatment. And so because I have had cancer, but also because I've received other people's blood products, which I can't put into words my gratitude for the kindness that they show by donating them. I'm unable to donate now.
How easy is it to make these donations, and how does that fit in with your Christian faith?
It seems the right thing to do. You know, if we think about stewardship, if stewardship's based around resources, well, these are natural resources which are God-given and which we have the ability to change lives by being involved in those donations. So, I mean, for me, it seems it didn't take much thought to be involved. That said, I recognise it's not for everyone, and I think, you know, if you're unable to donate for whatever reason, it may be that you have a phobia of needles. It can be anything at all. It doesn't make you any less a Christian, as long as you've, I would say, you've given consideration to how can you help. And if you can't donate, then of course you can be an advocate for donations, so you can go out there and spread the word, because you never know when you need to draw out of that bank.
What impact do you think the Diocesan Synod motion, having been passed at the General Synod, what impact do you think it will have?
I think it's about action. We've got it from deanery to diocesan to the National General Synod of the Church of England. And now what it needs is that needs to be sent out to each and every parish to encourage that group of people, Christian-minded people, to consider, can they donate blood or blood products? Can they go onto the national tissue and organ donation register? And to have those conversations actually with loved ones, because from my experience, when those conversations haven't taken place, it really is hard for the loved one to make that decision, because they're dealing with the grief of death and there's so much happening in their lives that actually it's easier to say no. And I've got to say, the majority of people that I asked said no. I hope that the conversation starts. I hope that we, you know, sort of get it into each parish. There's that great campaign, Flesh and Blood campaign, which the Church of England was one of the founding members of. And I hope, actually, that it doesn't stop there with Christians. I hope that those people who hear about this maybe listen to this podcast and maybe hear about it in church will go out and speak to other people and almost become evangelists for this great thing.
Once this group of sessions of the Synod had come to a close, Aaron Arora, Director of Communications for the Archbishop's Council, sat down with Harry Farley from Christian Today and Madeline Davies from the Church Times to get their reflections on what had taken place. They also discussed the Church of England's tweet from last weekend encouraging people to pray for Professor Richard Dawkins after it was reported that he had suffered from a minor stroke. Aaron started by asking Harry how his first Synod had been.
It's been fascinating. Mixture of very complicated church practice, trying to get my head around, and also really enjoyable meeting people in the fringe groups especially. I think that's probably been the highlight, has been the out of session meetings and lunches and getting to know people and trying to get my head around how Synod works behind the scenes.
Madeline, you're now a seasoned observer, into double figures in the number of synods you've seen. What about for you?
I think we've had a lot of renewal and reform, as it's now called, for the past few synods. So there is a kind of familiarity to some of the concerns which I think are expressed about that programme, and also a very sort of strong message, as I think John Spence said today, that there is a real agreement across synod, almost unanimous, that decline needs to be tackled and that there's an urgency about that. So I think that's coming through very strongly again.
Mads, one for you particularly. This is a new synod. 40% of the people in there are new. Did that change anything discernibly for you? Was there a change of tone or anything that you noticed that was different, say, from the last 5 years?
I think there's obviously less certainty about where people are coming from and what they're going to say. So I think people are maybe sort of listening afresh to each other because there's not that kind of predictability about what someone might say or what their stance on a particular thing might be. So I think it's sort of quite untested at the moment. And it's also quite nice the way people are introducing themselves by saying a bit about where they've come from, how they became a Christian, what their roles are. And it seems like there is some quite impressive experience out there and expertise.
Harry, you said that you've really enjoyed the fringes. Which of those has really stood out for you?
Well, I went to an eggs meeting on Monday night it was, and just seeing the range of people represented.
You might want to let people know what EGGS is.
EGGS is the Evangelical Group on General Synod, And so seeing some of the range of opinions represented there, and just understanding what the influence these groups have on Synod was particularly interesting.
Some of the reporting, particularly on Tuesday, the second day, concentrated on the debate around evangelism. Some of the speeches from Bishop Philip North, Mark Russell. Mads has touched already on the urgency issue. The fact that people are writing about this, that it's actually still getting in the press, is that a surprise?
Well, I think the Bishop of Burnley's address talking about church decline on urban estates was particularly interesting, and that we focused on that in Christian Today. I think the decline of the church in the poor areas, especially given that it is supposed to be a church for the poor, is particularly interesting. I think it was more the tone that he used than necessarily he was saying anything new that probably grabbed the attention, and the particular energy and passion that he had obviously grabbed a lot of us in the press room.
Yeah, I'd agree. So I actually ended up writing a feature a couple of years ago after a Philip North speech before he became bishop, where he talked about the difficulty of recruiting people to certain deprived areas. I think he'd worked on an estate in Middlesbrough. I remember being very inspired by that to go and investigate why that was the case. So I think he's a very powerful speaker, and it is a useful reminder to Synod that it exists for the poor, and I think he's an amazing advocate for those areas.
One of the other topics of debate was Scotland, the Columba Declaration. In the end, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing beforehand, it all seemed to go fairly smoothly. No suggestion, I think, of any rifts between churches. How did you both read that?
I spoke to Mark Russell afterwards, and he made the point he thought it was significant that nearly 100 people didn't vote for the amendment. He was sort of wanted to emphasise that. I didn't get the sense of any particular rift. Obviously, Justin Welby expressed his regret that the proposals came out before they were announced properly, but I didn't get the sense of any real rift.
Mandolin?
I think I've sort of seen some dissatisfaction expressed on social media, and I think, as Harris said, it was good that Justin Welby kind of tackled the way in which it had been presented, I guess. And I think often with these things, it's a matter of the way in which they come to public attention and are communicated. And there's probably some work to do there to kind of, I guess, mend some relationships and maybe some lessons to learn about how things are communicated in future.
You mentioned social media. Last of all, the week began here with lots of stories around a particular tweet about Richard Dawkins. What's been your take on that story, Madeline?
I think social media is a bit of a minefield, and you have a limited number of characters, as we all know, and I think things can very easily be misunderstood. I also think, in that particular area, there is always the potential for antagonism. And there's some very sort of clear battle lines that have been set up ever since, I guess, sort of Twitter originated. So it's a very tricky area. I think, plenty of people and Christians explained that this idea that you could pray for anyone and everyone, regardless of whether they're a Christian or whether you particularly get on with them, that is, a core tenet of the Christian faith. It's not unusual. It's something which Christians do. But Twitter is a tricky thing, and I'm not surprised necessarily that it provoked a bit of a reaction.
Harry?
I think it's really interesting that Twitter has become a news source, so people, seemingly random people's views can become a source of news now. Just by sort of replies or retweets, especially on a slow news day, can generate a headline. I think the news was probably really made by the Church of England launching a defence of it, I think it would probably have been passed by fairly unnoticed if it hadn't been for that public defence and those who were sort of just catching up with that it might have caused controversy with one or two on Twitter. I think it was that defence that really made it a headline.
Harry Farley and Madeline Davies there with Aaron Arora. Finally, as Easter approaches, we are hearing from women and men who have found faith at a fresh expression of church in Halifax called the Saturday Gathering. In the next instalment of the Just Pray series, we hear from Rob, who spent years living rough and has since seen his life turned around.
I've always believed in that resurrection, but my mind was clouded through drugs, and like when I started being clear-headed and things like that, I thought, wow. If a human being can get resurrected after dying, he's done it to me. Like, I haven't died, but I feel like I've been resurrected away from a life of crime and trouble and that to peace, love, understanding, calmness. I found it difficult having a lifestyle that I used to have, showing my feelings, because like I thought, if I show my feelings, people would tread on you and I wouldn't be like this like hard person that people thought I was. And I had to pretend I was hard to live on the streets. If you don't pretend you're hard, or you show your feelings on the streets, you're gonna get like trod on, spat at, all sorts of things, nasty things happen to you. It used to be hard to show my feelings, but now I show them and I don't care about showing my feelings. I cry a lot because of like Jesus died for me, and I never used to think that. I used to just think it was just another man, another book, blah blah blah. It makes me feel joyful because like someone died and then like come back to life, like a kick in the teeth, isn't it? Ha! You're never gonna let me get down. I don't cry because I'm sad. I cry because I'm like for joy. It's like, wow, how can one man die for everyone who lived, who lives now, for everyone else's sins? It's just like, it's unbelievable, isn't it? It's like, it's deep. Well, I felt forsaken at first when my brother died. He was only like 21. I felt God forsaken me then because I knew he was going to kill himself and I wasn't allowed to help him because I was on drugs myself. And after, well, when he died, I got naughty, I got into drugs, I got into fighting, violence, prison. And when I was in prison, I wanted to, like, just die. I thought God was forsaking me then, because I was asking for his help. And it didn't happen until I come to Halifax. Coming to this place 5 years ago, coming to Ebenezer's 5 years ago. I walked in on a Saturday night and I thought, the church open on a Saturday? And I was on the streets at the time and it was really bad. I was dying. And I met Linda, Dave, a few other people. And he just took me in and it was just like overwhelmed. I was just like overwhelmed with like, wow, how people can be like that. And they're not even taking drugs. Like, people are taking on when you're taking drugs, when they're taking drugs too. But these people are not taking drugs. And I thought, they don't want me for anything. They just want me to like better myself, make a much better life for myself. They don't want anything off you, just like love and things like that, which I had the problem with, of like loving people and things. I had a difficult life with my family, so love wasn't like on the agenda. It was like violence mostly. Violence and abuse. But now, about 10 years later, I've turned into a Christian, I've like changed my life around, and God hasn't forsaken me. He's just kept me on hold.
And you can hear the third part of our Just Pray series next week. For more in the meantime, go to justpray.uk. That's all for this week's podcast. Remember to follow us on Twitter at @C_of_E and like us on Facebook to stay up to date with all that's going on across the Church of England. Thanks for listening.